So we're really privileged to have with us Mike Leipold. Mike's particular integrating theme is called Digital Earth Exchange, DEX, and it's a vision of there being a place where all these communities join together and can exchange on a global platform and as a global community. So I've just had a quick look through Mike's presentation, and you'll see that all the themes of the conference are expressed there. So as Mike speaks, you might just want to be reflecting on, yes, I can see that, and listen deeply within to the richness of what was there for you during the week. During the rest of the morning, we're going to take two particular things. We're going to have a panel up the front to take your reflections on what so and what next. We'll be taking morning coffee at about 10:30, and out in the foyer, for those of you who may not have noticed, we've got the map by the artist of the Earth Cafe yesterday, and you may find that kind of interesting to map some of your inspirations and ideas. And I'm sure that there will be people here who weren't there, so that you'll have some other things. And the other thing we're going to weave into the morning, just for the sheer gee whiz factor of it all, is John Graham from the San Diego Supercomputer Center was the man who supported Planet Walker on his journey. He mentioned him. So he's going to take us on a sort of an exquisite technological thread at some point during the day. We're going to finish by lunchtime. And we are interested, and that was the we with a capital W, in what the future is. So we'd like something to come out of this morning that actually takes us all forward together. We've now got everyone here who needs to be here, because Felicity just arrived. And so we invite Mike Leipold.
Great. And if we can get someone to flip the switch on the display, we'll be set.
Just do it up a little tighter.
I am plugged in, but I don't know what.
This man is very good at these things.
Meanwhile, while we're setting up the display, thank you again for inviting me to come and talk here, and I'm honored and grateful to meet with you all. The whole notion of a digital earth is something I've worked on since 1979. I wrote a plan for a bioregional hypermedia atlas of California, mapping out all the ecosystems in California, and on the basis of that design, Alan Kay hired me to come and work in his research laboratory at Atari Research. Alan was the chief scientist at Atari in those days. And I was fortunate at the time to be able to work with a whole group of researchers who had come west from the MIT Architecture Machine Group. Most people haven't heard of the Architecture Machine Group, but it was a group that existed before the Media Lab that was working on something called SDMS, or Spatial Data Management System. And the Architecture Machine Group had a radical view of cartography. It was the idea that a cartographic view, which is explicitly a downward view from above looking at the planet, could be flipped up so that we could have a cinematic view of the world, a cinematic view of cartographic digital data. And there were some really wonderful pioneering works done by that group at Atari, and then later a group of us moved over to Apple. And so I spent 10 years at Apple working on a variety of digital Earth-related projects under the rubric of a Terraform project. So many of the things that have been implemented by GeoFusion and Google Earth and Microsoft Earth and Worldwind were things that we pioneered in really terrible hand-wired prototypes back in the late 80s and early 90s at Apple, and eventually had to retire because we were just 10 years ahead of our time. So I'm delighted to see now that so much work in technology and social development has brought us to this point now where we really have some robust frameworks for a true digital Earth. Through a cast of thousands, we've reached a technical foundation for the future. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today, is where do we go forward? Should probably turn my screensaver off here. So I'm currently working for a group called the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California. And we're a group that doesn't predict the future. Rather, we forecast the future by aggregating expert opinions from people like you. So we'll work together and we'll develop some consensus views of what the future might be like in a very, very broad sense. And we work on some vivid views. So some of the work I'm going to show today reflects some of that future-looking view, but basically it's a snapshot of where we are and some of the challenges going forward to build a truly robust and ubiquitous digital earth. So I'd like to start off with this image that John Graham may recognize. This was produced by the guys at UCAR. This is called the Everything Globe, and it's a demonstration of data sets from the Geon Grid, a project that, that John and his colleagues are working on. And to me, it gives a sense of what we're striving for. We're striving for a digital representation of everything we can. We want information about every aspect of the planet, because as many people have pointed out, the planet is a closed system with a lot of symbiotic parts, where human activities and natural activities work in symbiosis and in synergy, ideally. And so a digital Earth is going to give us the tools to optimize the human synergy with the natural planet. So a digital Earth exchange, by any other name, is the web. It's unlikely we're going to have one big, giant data vault in concrete, 10,000 feet below the Colorado Rockies or the South Island of New Zealand. The information about the planet is going to be distributed. And it's going to be distributed across the web. So we can see up here a whole bag of jargon. A digital Earth exchange, a World Wide Web, a Web 2.0, a geo-web, a geospatial web. They're all buzzwords. But the fact is that we are building on the web social and technical mechanisms for sharing data of all kinds. And today, we're now seeing the capability of sharing three fundamental types of data. Cartographic data. Data that exists in vectors, polygons, points, and rasters on servers. We're looking at sharing user-created hypermedia. Pages or documents or videos or graphics that have geographic coordinates attached to them, served on the web, and can be served up spatially. And finally, real-time sensor data. So I'm going to breeze through a few thoughts on the integration of these three things, which could easily be construed as a geo-web, a geospatial web, or a digital Earth exchange. So first, we're seeing the birth of a true mobile GIS, where people can gather, create, and view geodata with the wireless devices. And this gives people a tremendous capability to know and experience and interact the world in very, very rich ways. And to show you what I mean, I have a thought experiment that I conduct almost compulsively, and it's something that you might enjoy doing when you walk outside. Imagine you can see the invisible data draped across the world. For every place on Earth, there are environmental attributes that have been mapped. There are economic attributes. There are cultural attributes. There are attributes of the physical objects in front of you. And until the advent of wireless technologies, all of that information has been invisible to us. It's only been available to us in our heads, what we know, what we've been told, what we've learned. Now with new wireless technologies, the invisible attributes of places are about to be revealed to us, and it's going to fundamentally change the way we can interoperate with our own planet. So we've seen a lot of spinning globes this last week at the Digital Earth Conference. Today, this is sort of the bottom end of the telescope looking upwards. It's geodata from a first-person point of view. So we're creating the capability for people to create their own ground truth, for people to understand where they are, what they're doing in a dramatically new way, a much more intimate way. There's going to be no intellectual barriers between ourselves and the information about places and the information about things. So this has some great implications. It's going to give us collective power to change political structure. Now, in America, the Democrats and the Republicans have got most of the great mapping tools for building their political consensus. In San Francisco, we have something else. And so up on the map is a map that was created by the Indy voters for the mayoral campaign last year. So we're seeing now that ordinary citizens, by the way, not Democrats or Republicans, can begin to organize themselves and to view their political and social landscape in new ways. In the top corner is a map that some of you may have heard about at WHERE 2.0 that some people, Skylar Earle and some of his colleagues from a working group in Mumbai created. Before, very recently, mapping data was not widely available to the public in India, so people decided to go and create their own maps. So using GPS devices, people would travel the streets of Mumbai and record track logs and then created a map. And what's really important about this map is that within 2 weeks of starting the process to create an open map of Mumbai, the volunteers discovered a huge city block that was ostensibly public property, had been sold by the bureaucrats as commercial development and a giant high-rise development had built on public lands. So we're talking about empowering people to take control and understand places in a much more intimate way. We're giving people, and we heard a lot about indigenous applications of spatial technologies, we're giving people, indigenous peoples, and developing communities the ability to record their own stories and to take control and take management of their own environments. This photograph on the left is from a group down in Central America known as the GPSistas, a group that's resisting the overrun of their rainforest by large international resource companies. So a simple GPS, mobile GIS tools, is giving people to map their own communities, to record their sacred stories of the place, to record their insight in the botanical treasures and the animal treasures and the environmental treasures, and to begin to actually create an information base for dealing with the modern technology world that's coming down upon them. We're seeing a spectrum of environmental management views of the planet. Not only are we empowering scientists to create macro ecological models or micro climatic models, we're giving ordinary people the ability to experience the abundance of our natural planet. So we're seeing the birth of a new kind of ecotourism, a kind of tourism that's technology-enabled. There are now parks in Switzerland, Central America, and elsewhere where people with mobile devices, as they move through wild places, can begin to see the story of the habitats that they're passing through, to understand the source of water, to understand the tensions over encroaching development and pollution. So we're having a new capability develop as well. And this one has great, great promise for environmental applications as well. Not only are we going to have the ability to view the information about places, but there's a new capability coming online. That's the ability to see the probabilities of things happening. If you think about it, we now exist in the era of the metacomputer. No longer are we limited to the computational power we can carry in our hand, but this device here is a broadband terminal to infinite computing power, abundant computing power on the network. Google already has almost 1 million generic Linux boxes harnessed into one operating system, one computational environment. And so Google Search is, of course, the first application of the Google metacomputer. Google Earth is a growing application of a metacomputer capability. And we're seeing the demonstrations of other metacomputing projects, other spatial metacomputing projects on the great broadband experimental networks like the Lambda Rail, the international fiber optic network is developing. So if you can have infinite computing power, well, not infinite, but abundant computing power on a network, that means that there are new kinds of data mining that we can do. That means we can take vast amounts of data and sort through the data, filter it, recognize and sort patterns, and synthesize conclusions dynamically as we move through the world. So the portable device becomes a viewer for the probable risks, change the variables, other kinds of risks. So we can see, as for example, in an urban environment, is it safe to park my car here? Well, the computing on the network can calculate the probability of your car being stolen. And so the same kinds of probability calculations can be used for our environmental impact as we move through the world. A friend of mine, Rich Gibson, is working on something he calls the Internet of Values. It's the idea of being mindful about those things that are important to us as we move through the world. So if our device or our system is aware of the context that we move through and able to constantly be aware of the implications, the carbon production of our consumption, the carbon production of our movement, the damage that we're doing, or the constructive impact we're having, and the probabilities of outcomes, we are giving tremendous leveraged power to every one of us as we move through the physical world. So we see the beginnings of this work in public health. There's enormous interest now in public health communities for using mobile devices and probabilistic analysis to understand much in a much deeper way the geography of human health. And we're seeing, in fact, the idea of citizens creating to this database. For example, when the SARS epidemic broke out in Hong Kong, people were able to walk along and text message to a server and begin to create a map of hazardous buildings. So one can easily imagine this kind of citizen sensing being applied to all kinds of projects for the health and benefit of the planet. In fact, there's a huge program underway now at UCLA on citizen sensing, and there's networks now of citizen sensing projects. In fact, Eric Paulos here at Berkeley, Deborah Estern's group at UCLA are now beginning to look at how citizens with mobile devices and sensors can start contributing to a better and deeper understanding. So all of us might trivially be able to gather this kind of data. The top map is a soil sample map. The bottom map is an air quality map. And so this kind of information is not only information that we can create and share, but it's also information that will work dynamically with our health sensors. You know, last winter, I took a look at the medical literature on consumer electronic devices, and I found out that in a three-month period last year, over 30 kinds of wearable sensors had been introduced. Sensors that will check your pulse, your respiratory rate, your galvanic skin response, brain activity. And so increasingly in medical communities, people are seeing that the mobile device is a hub for a personal network, a body area network. So one can imagine is that we're constantly gathering and synthesizing a database of our own physiological reaction as we move through the world. And so it's going to be increasingly important for this personal data to interact with the data regarding the environmental quality and the air quality. In fact, you might even know which areas of a city are more stressful for you to visit. And that might inform a new kind of geography and urban geography, so we design healthier places just by the physiological way that people are responding to places. So the notion of the geography of health is as much about health and healthy places as it is in sickness and sick places. So I think we need to turn these applications forward to make the planet more habitable, not necessarily just to be able to diagnose hotspots of human illness and human danger. So I like to think of the tricorder. Tricorder was a gadget that I think many people know that was carried around by Spock and Kirk. And if Michael Jones from Google was here, he probably had his tricorder slide too. It's a device that Spock would whip out when he landed on a planet. And he'd push a button and it would tell him everything about an alien planet. It would tell him everything about the atmosphere of the planet, the plants on the planet, the language they speak on the planet. Well, it's time for us to build a tricorder for planet Earth. But the problem, of course, is that the simplicity of the idea of a tricorder for planet Earth, something that can tell us everything about our environment, is that there's an enormous complexity in data management, data processing, and data exchange behind the idea of a simple personal geodata reader. So each of these kinds of data types, and there's many, many kinds of data types that you might want to view and operate on or have your system work contextually for you, every one of these has all kinds of different data formats, namespaces, markups, schemas, ontologies, storage systems, network access. And so as a society, as a human society, we have a lot of large-scale IT work to do. We have to build an infrastructure to make the tricorder, along with the digital Earth, a viable reality. So the tricorder is just another aspect of the everything globe. The everything globe is just looking at the planet from space. The tricorder is looking at it from here, from on the ground. So one of the first things we need to do is really comprehensively understand what we have to do in geospatial search. Now, in some of these things, Google is diving in. And Google is clearly making an investment, but there's a lot more that has to be done. The problem is that geodata about the planet exists all over the world in just an idiosyncratic menagerie of one stops. There's more than one stop, by the way. If you want your data, you have to stop at more than one stop. Clearinghouses, gateways, repositories, archives, portals, map servers, feature servers, place servers. Mining geodata is a really tough problem. There are several problems that Michael Goodchild talks about a lot, and I think he probably touched on some of these problems in his talk here. The fact is that the geodata, the data about our planet, is not properly described. Most of the map data that was created for the world exists on a server somewhere with a file name like XY3GN4D2. You can't search for it. And if you search for it, you don't know what it is. And what it might be is a blue line. But you don't know that blue line is a river until you gather another file, which is a labels file, that you lay them down next to each other, and it says, oh, Mississippi River. The reason is that most geodata that exists on servers today was created to be viewed squashed together in maps. In the old days, people thought they were going to take their geodata, and yeah, it was going to exist in a file, but the only time anybody would ever use it, if you squash it all together into one flat raster and send it to a big old printer. And so the individual data elements, which have incredible value as an interoperable part of a whole Earth data system, are not available because they're named improperly. And the problem is not only that the individual files, a blue line for the Mississippi River, is improperly named. It's that the entire file itself isn't properly named. No one knows that it's actually a map of the watershed of the Mississippi Delta. It has some bizarre name that can't easily be searched. So we have bad metadata for the layers. We have bad metadata for the maps. And frankly, a lot of the libraries and clearinghouses have bad metadata about their collections. They don't even know what they have in their collections. So this is a challenge for us to use this tremendous computational power that we've got coming online to look back at our legacy, our legacy knowledge base of human space, of the digital planet. We've got to go back and find ways to recover this data because it's priceless. So we need intelligent systems that can look at these files and then send them back out with appropriate labels so they can be reused. Otherwise, it's going to be thrown away. It's going to be blown in the wind. It's ephemeral data. It's like the Alexandria Library that burned down, you know, centuries of human knowledge lost. So there's a genuine challenge for us here in handling all of these. Now, there's another deeper technical problem that I can talk about only briefly. The U.S. government, in its wisdom, about 8 years ago, formed the Federal Geospatial Coordinating Committee. Tom Khalil talked about that. It was, you know, following Tom Khalil's and Vice President Gore's vision. And all the federal agencies of the U.S. Were herded together and said, you guys should share data. Tim Forsman was there. Tim was the leader of that program. The idea is that the data from the Bureau of Land Management should work with the data from the Tiger map base from Commerce. And the USGS data should work with the oceanographic data. And the environmental data should work with demographic data. And what a brilliant idea. And at the same time, the Open Geospatial Consortium was formed, and we developed these open standards, web feature server for map layers and web map server for raster tiles, and GML, a geographic markup language. And so the data could be described universally and exchanged universally. And so now our current administration, in its wisdom, has decided to outsource the U.S. government database. You know, the last administration said we will create a geospatial one-stop and serve all of the geodata of America that we can to the public for free use. And by the way, it's something we need to be proud of as Americans. America leads the world in the creation and consumption of geodata by our federal government, and our federal government leads the world in sharing geodata of all resources for public reuse. And we're just learning how to use that data, and here it is sitting now behind some proprietary servers, these ArcIMS servers and other servers that are, and in fact, proprietary. You have to log on and use a proprietary query language to find out what's in the public database. Now, Tim Berners-Lee, the founder of the World Wide Web, has an idea that I think we all have to explore deeply, and they've built some prototypes at the Ordnance Survey, the British National Mapping Agency. Tim Berners-Lee says what we need is an intermediate layer or a shim, and he proposes something called a Sparkle server, which is a server that actually has a publicly crawlable index that sits outside the proprietary database using a query language based on something called the Resource Description Framework, RDF and OWL, which are the core components of a semantic web that describe the relationships between things. And so there are people now beginning to build these open source intermediate servers that sit on top of the geospatial one-stop servers and other proprietary ESRI servers. Environmental Systems Research is the sort of the Microsoft of GIS. They've got like an 80 or 90% share of production and creation of public geodata. And so it was a natural thing for them to want to implement something like this. But for those of us who want to use geodata for public service, we need a better way to get at it. And so perhaps the Tim Berners-Lee's ideas are the way to go on this. So we have now the beginnings of the whole mashup culture. We've got end users scraping code from Google and Yahoo and creating their own maps. And the fact is that up until about a year ago, you couldn't view data from a Google map on a Yahoo map or data from a Yahoo map on a Microsoft map, and you couldn't read any of them on an ESRI map. But the good news is there's been this grassroots movement completely outside the standards movement, completely outside the formal communities that said we need to be able to bridge the world of cartography and the web with a common, simple way to tag web objects. And they came up with something called GORSS. It's just a very, very simple semantic for tagging a web object and making it viewable on a map. And the good news is that Microsoft has fully embraced GORSS. Yahoo has been using an earlier version of GORSS for over a year. Google has embraced GORSS. And now there are millions and millions of points of data on the network now encoded with a standard GORSS latitude and longitude coordinate. So this means that user-created geodata can be shared. It doesn't make any difference if you've got a Google Earth viewer or you've got a Microsoft Earth viewer. If you have a Microsoft Earth viewer or an ESRI viewer, the data has its own independent value. And so we have to constantly keep this notion of interoperability at the forefront. Because some of the big spinny globe guys you heard here would love to herd people over into their technological garden and then have the entire digital earth grow up within their definition and their constraints. And so we as a community who want to apply geospatial technologies for the benefit of the environment, for the benefit of humanity, have got to keep them honest, keep them working. And so it's great news that GRSS has been widely adopted. So we're seeing, as I mentioned, the rise of a personal cartography. And I think that the creation, particularly of this Mapping Hacks book, and if you don't have a copy of this book, please stop by the Cal Berkeley bookstore and buy one on your way out. This is a Bible of about 130 hacks using open source data and open source tools that empower every citizen of the planet to start creating their own spatial reality. So we're seeing now the ability for people, as I said, to create their own truth. Interesting thing about this placial map up here is this is a perfect example of the value of GRSS. All of these points on this map, while shown on a Google map, are just simply GRSS points. So you can take the map out from underneath the data and project the data on a Yahoo map, or a Microsoft map, or an Esri map, or a Whirlwind globe, or a Digital Earth globe. It gives us great, great freedom from the dictates of the large mapping companies. So one of the challenges with user-created data is similar to the challenges faced with dealing with formal cartographic data. You know, as I said, the cartographers and map makers didn't label their data. Well, the good news is that ordinary people are labeling their data, but they're not using very formal language. Now, when a biologist goes out and he starts mapping species in a rainforest, he has real formal language based on his discipline. Or a geologist who maps rock samples, he's going to use his particular language to describe that place. Somebody who's mapping the facilities on a lake will map it all using the language of infrastructure and regulations. A biologist will map that lake using the language of microclimates and habitat and ecosystems. But the thing is that users, when they tag their data, use any old words that they think of. You know, we've seen things like Flickr, Delicious, Dig, and lots of these systems that have stimulated people into using metadata to describe things. You know, Flickr tags on photographs give you a great ability to view everybody's photographs of Pudong, China. You know, you can just type in Pudong in Flickr and see all the pictures that everybody took. But the problem is that user-created tags of geodata, using tools like Placial, lack the coherence to be mined effectively. So this is yet another really major computer science challenge, is to take all of the casual geodata that users have created and map it against formal ontologies, like the federal geospatial metadata standard. Yeah, John can say it when he gets up here. There are now beginnings of, in both the World Wide Web community and in the geospatial community, frameworks for human metadata and scientific metadata. So we have to find ways of combining wild web geodata with the formal ontologies of all the academic and scientific disciplines. In fact, one of the case points that I like to talk about, in fact, we used it in a piece that we did in the IEEE Persuasive Computing magazine this month. We did a large article on data in the World Wide Sensor Web. And if you just think about it, think about, for example, the avian flu virus as a data point. So the virus exists in the wild, say somewhere up in northern Siberia, and that data becomes attached to a migrating bird. So that data then moves to the tropics. And so then there's a data that's associated with an infection of that virus in the tropics. And as the birds move around, the data moves with them. So then as the infection moves, the public health community starts keeping data records about that virus. And so then the data moves from the public health planning community into the medical practitioners community, into a hospital. And then from the hospital, the data about that virus moves into a patient record. And what I'm trying to say is that we need data that can move across domains, across scientific domains. So we have data that zoologists and field botanists are using in northern Siberia having an impact in a public health clinic in Orange County, California. And so a lot of these right now, in the way the computer systems are organized in our world here in 2007, are all these little stovepipe computing systems that don't necessarily think about sharing data across domains. So we need the similar kind of data sharing for meta-scale environmental analysis. You know, if you look at a large habitat like the Amazon rainforest, my God, you've got scientific data, you've got probably 200 kinds of botanical information with different botanical metadata. You've got water specialists, you've got arborists, you've got ethnobotanists, you've got cultural anthropologists there. All have got data about the Amazon ecosystem. All that data has to work together. So there's a tremendous challenge ahead of us normalizing these spatial ontologies and then normalizing them with personal tag metadata. So this is a challenge. So as much as we have a beautiful vision of a digital Earth with these lovely spinning globes and fly-through views of terrains, the actual practical data about the environment of the planet still is not snapped together and interoperating the way ideally it should be. And so we're seeing some development now, some real productive convergence. In the old days, we had lots and lots of legacy data, and I talked a little bit about these Esri servers up here that have some sort of web service interface. The good news is that the open GIS community now has suites of tools that have reached maturity to the point where they're really robust and practical to use. So we have the ability now to convert and render data and serve data and view data using completely open standard, free open source tools. So this is going to empower people all over the world to build and share data using common frameworks. So we're seeing now the beginnings of some next generation mapping applications using these open standards evolving. And these open standards, by the way, are all various flavors of XML. Geographic markup languages, a variety of the web feature service. Web feature service is written in GML, and it's an XML variation. Now, on the web side here, up until very recently, we had the old web, and that's the web as we know it. That's web with no geospatial relevance. But people now, using tools like GRSS, are beginning to code objects geospatially. So we're moving from this legacy web to a user-created web. Now, there's something fundamentally different about the web in a technical sense, where cartographic data really usually resides in a database. Web data exists on HTTP servers. Now, just in the past few years, computer scientists have discovered a new technique called REST, RESTful access to data. And it's just using the HTTP capability to put and get data. So just using a URL as a file address or saving data as a file address gives us the ability to start serving all kinds of user-created data using open web standards. And so we're seeing now these web user experiments beginning up here. Whoop, I'm going to back up a little bit. And we're seeing new usage models, and GRSS really sits at the center of this. Now, up at the very top level, we have some proprietary things, Flash, Microsoft's ActiveX, and what do they call it, Starlight now? And then there's Ajax up there. And KML is very interesting because KML is Google's keyhole markup language. It's a variation of GML. It's GML that's been tuned, changed, and morphed, and it has things like the point of view of your camera as you move through a digital space. And it has some other features, the ability to insert things like photographs with geotags on them and all kinds of new widgets. The good news is Google has announced that they're turning KML over to the Open Geospatial Committee for community definition. So the current version of KML 2.2 is the last version that will be developed solely by Google. The version 3.0 is going to go to a new OGC community, an open list. And for those of you who are interested in such a thing, it's called the Mass Geo List. And they are going to open up and embrace community input for the definition of KML. So if you listen to Google, Google will say that KML is the way to identify data down here. They would, you know, since they are the fountainhead of KML development, they, of course, would like the user-created GeoWeb to be a KML web. The good news is they recognize fait accompli, the existence of GRSS, and Google will honor GRSS as well. But KML has become a rather important factor. So as we look at the future of a digital Earth exchange, we have to recognize that a lot of data that we want to use is going to be in KML format. In fact, KML and Google Earth have become the preferred viewer in many communities for viewing spatial information, even data that's created in open source tools or using ArcGIS tools. People like the ease of use and the ubiquity of Google Earth. And so it seems like the Google Earth viewer could become the Netscape navigator for the GeoWeb. And so I think it's a good sign that Google acts like they want to be really open about the development. But we have to keep them honest. And so we can't let them run away with the spec of a geospatial web. We all have to get involved and move the definition of the GeoWeb forward. So another really, really critical challenge here is the fact is that cartography is no longer two-dimensional. Cartography is 3D. We're talking about data in volumes, not data in tiles. And so there's a real genuine challenge because many, many communities describe data in three dimensions in different ways. And not only did they describe the coordinates of the data in different ways, they describe the rules for using the data in different ways. They describe the physics of the rendering in different ways. They describe the viewing models in different ways. And so we have a lot of work together to normalize 3D cartography, computer-aided design, real world, virtual worlds, and augmented reality all into an interoperable data set. So we need to be able to view things, to build things on top of the wonderful terrain models that you saw here. We need to build these models of the planet in ways so we can model our ecosystems, so we can model them in great detail. So not only can we do simple probability, but we can do very, very rich and complicated simulations to simulate the health of an ecosystem and the complex relationships of human interaction with the planet. So at the Institute for the Future, we did a survey about 3 years ago on how ready the planet is for a digital Earth exchange or a geospatial web. And the results, I think, are somewhat predictable, although they've changed over the last 4 years. Since we didn't have any real metrics, we took a look at the availability of Wi-Fi location or GPS capabilities, the presence of repositories, public repositories. You know, in many of these developing countries, all they have is like two or three layers of data, like the political boundaries, the roads, and maybe the waterways. You know, there might be independent scientists who come and visited a Central African country, but they took their data away with them back to Belgium or Italy or America. And so there's not really robust models, environmental data coverage in a lot of these places. So we need to really work to build up these national one-stops and these national data repositories. So in the end, let's just recall the goal of our work on a digital Earth exchange is to really make sure that we can have multidisciplinary spatial knowledge that we can share for the betterment of the planet and our lovely environment. Thank you.
Wahoo. Can you hear me? Y'all.
Sorry, everybody.
That's good. It's a very distinct way to start. Why don't we take a few questions? It's 10:15. I think coffee will be available in 10 minutes or so. Mike, great presentation. You know, I asked someone a few weeks ago, what was the absolute heart of Digital Earth? If you just stripped it back to the bare minimum, they said, probably the international acceptance of a small number of core standards is what's going to keep this alive. And then there is all the communities around the outside. So what we've had in this conference is the convergence of people who can speak the language that just Mike spoke, and around that all the rich range of communities who need this. So I've got a few questions myself. Although I'm a geomorphologist and obviously work in meta-process and with human beings a lot, I had a period of my life when I worked on the implementation of the ISO 19115 standard across Australasia with ANZLIC. So I kind of spoke that language, and it's kind of nice in a weird way to find my past life re-emerging. So there may be some people here who can speak FGDC and 19115 and RDF and the rest, and then there's some healthy people who can't. But But what I liked in the underlying intention of your paper is how do we all connect together? And what I think is elegant is these are all bridging conversations. So we've got one question here. I've got a couple myself. Thank you. Sir?
The notion of a taxonomy for place description and maybe entity identification. There was a discussion last week at the Ware Camp, and I was talking to the chief scientist for Palatial. Garmin and Magellan, because of the consumer adoption of GPS devices, are opening up their API sets, but there's not a process in place for a common tag base for that, and it seems like some policy stuff needs to happen, like when you get an occupational license, you know, you put lat long in it and some descriptive tags, but where's the appropriate standards body or whatever to, you know, push the development of that process so we can get a, you know, a more focused indexing process rather than having to do, you know, a fuzzy search through the Google index engine?
Well, I think the World Wide Web Consortium. The World Wide Web Consortium, you know, is part of their work is building standard ontologies as part of web descriptions. And the OGC has lots of ways of describing language in standard ways, too. For tag data, you know, I'm not sure that we want to force people to use controlled language. I think the beauty of a tagged internet is people can use any language they want. It's just up to us as information scientists find ways to translate it. So, you know, if you say creek, I know that you mean rivulet. You know, I mean, it's a matter of building a meta thesaurus. Now, Chris Goad, who you talked to at WareCamp, who is the chief scientist at Palatial, has an idea that's really quite consistent with Tim Berners-Lee work about an independent layer described in RDF. A way of describing creating these lightweight intermediate servers, and some of his use the JavaScript object notation JSON.
Right.
But the idea that it's got to be scalable, it's got to be small, it's got to be lightweight. We can't impose one language on humanity, and we can't. I don't think we can gather all the data in one place to normalize it. Although Google is creating the most massive index of everything on the planet, and so Google is going to have their indices. But I think it's good for us to think about the kind of the grassroots requirements we have for naming and using and labeling and recovering data.
Ed, oh, you first.
Hi. David Herring in the Earth Sciences Division at NASA Goddard.
Thanks,
I wonder if you've given thought. I like the vision. It's a great vision, and it seems to be heading that way. I wonder if you've given thought to quality assurance or validation, ensuring that these data, the accuracy and the validity of these data, if you think that's a problem, and what, if anything, folks could also do to give indicators or flags or tag the information that gives some sort of sense of the validity of the data.
Yeah, I think that's a problem consistent with every other piece of data on the web. You know, you have to apply some sort of external criteria. And so I believe that some sort of social networks and some sort of formalized reputation networks for the creators and the sources of the data will evolve. So I don't know how you can enforce standards of authenticity. I think all of the scientific communities and academic communities probably ought to work on this. All the biological sciences, the life sciences, the physical sciences, environmental sciences probably want to work on their own ways of identifying the source and is the data juried or independently reviewed, or is it or what kind of heuristic or algorithm was used to do the smoothing? Sometimes the curve of a line actually has critical importance, and even though the data sampled has great integrity, the mathematics used to render it don't. And so I think it's a huge academic challenge across the board. And I don't think anybody's really raised the issue to the proper level yet. And so I think it's a really great topic for things like the Federal Geospatial Coordinating Committee, you know, and other international bodies that are looking at normalizing geodata.
So as a great question, David, and so that as a question to the community collectively, this is a question around as institutions shift from old paradigms of control, and it's demonstrated by the present shift in the American administration. towards a what sounds like a very foolish model where they had one of the best in the world. As we transition to self-organizing communities globally, how do we facilitate the evolution of collective intelligence such that those tasks like quality are cared for more quickly rather than less quickly? Have you got any sense, Mike, of how, so rather than waiting for the emergence of, how can we facilitate the emergence of an intelligent approach?
Well, I mean, I think the good news is in the midst of all this geospatial revolution, we've got a revolution in social computing.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of new mechanisms on the network now for people to share and validate and create community knowledge. And so I think it's just a continual examination of the community social knowledge building tools that started with Delicious and others and refined those into a science. And there are beginnings of work in those communities on social knowledge building. And some of the laboratories now are really beginning to look at the issues of how this can be organized coherently. At the Institute for the Future, we're now using versions of Delicious style knowledge building. We're building private knowledge bases. And so I think it has great practice. And so it's in a small user group, since we know everyone who created the data, there's a certain integrity to the data and value to the data. And I think it's a scalable and extensible model.
Very good. This is why New Zealand works, because everyone knows one another. Perfect segue to Ed, because Ed's contribution, along with One Village Foundation, to the conference has been, he was passing around this little $100 laptop from the MIT Media Lab that Google lent him. And the frontier these guys were bringing is what happens as the mesh networks go into the third world, or what we call the third world, with 6.5 billion participants rather than the elite. So, Ed.
Yeah. Well, just to start, consider globe.org, which, although defunded in the United States, is still active internationally. They put weather stations in schools. We propose to provide weather stations to all the schools for 1 billion children, where the data will be brought to a central location daily, scrubbed, analyzed, mapped, and published, and will then come back to the communities where these children live and help their families with agriculture and other enterprises. So that's just the starting point. Then, of course, we started thinking with all the people here who know about all the other possibilities for mapping, of mapping the air and water quality and the health and the agriculture and the nutrition and you tell us, and because I know there's more, and finding some place to gather the data in each case. And again, to do the necessary data cleaning and validation and metadata tagging and mapping and delivery to the rest of the world in compatible formats so that we can map disease, various diseases, across Africa or wherever, and at the same time we can map nutrition. And it turns out there's a notable case where an ophthalmologist discovered children who are going blind for lack of vitamin A. And you can't do research on that in the United States. You can't find anybody who's that vitamin A deficient in the United States. But it turns out that in addition to going blind, they were dying. And there was no medical model for that. So that took quite a while to figure out. And the medical model has now been found for why they would die in addition to going blind. So although initially the doctors wouldn't accept the word of an ophthalmologist, they accepted their research people, and who is providing vitamin A drops twice a year in northern India, Nepal, and wherever else they find that this is an issue. So this kind of mapping would have made it much easier to discover this phenomenon, would have brought attention to it much sooner, and so on. And now we'll be able to do that. So we can perhaps go and map river blindness in Africa and Brazil, where the disease is known to exist, where the treatment is being provided, and look to see why there might be a region where people aren't taking the medicine, and then go ask why. So between getting all the children together and getting all the experts to do the rest of the work that you've been discussing, we're going to have a huge number of more layers in all those places that you showed in the dire colors of much of Africa.
I think it's a noble goal, and I think it's one of the foundations for a digital earth exchange is harnessing the power
yes.
of children.
So
I wanted to mention something. If you guys haven't already done it, a friend of mine walked up to me at Wear 2.0 last week, and he said, can I use your memory stick for a second? And so I said, sure. And he gave it back to me, and on this little memory stick, a little cheap memory stick, is a complete full-featured web server and a complete full-featured mapping client. And it's all free open-source software. It's called OpenLayers, and it's called Feature Server. And it's from a group right there in Cambridge, Mass. And so it's the kind of thing you don't have to be beholden to Google or Microsoft or Esri. This
exactly.
is free right now.
This is the sort of thing where we want you to tell us to get a hold of those people, to put it on the One Laptop Per Child Wiki and go talk to Walter Bender and
sure.
everybody else who is responsible for figuring out what software should be on the unit as delivered. And that's an ideal contribution.
Great. Well, it's called Open Layers, and it's called Feature Server.
But I wanted you to suggest where we might go with 1 billion children. Or just start with 6 million this year in Latin America and Africa.
Well, you know, I think that... If you're asking me what are the funding agencies, I don't know who the funding
agencies. No, not funding.
Okay.
The governments are buying the computer. Let's say it's funded. Now, what would you like to see the children do?
First thing is get out some pencils and paper.
Very good.
Walk around and teach the children spatial literacy.
Mm. Okay.
Have them map their communities, map the stories, map their resources. And
right.
then over time, teach them the digital skills. But first, you've got to get them oriented in a new way to think about spatial information.
Right.
Most people don't think about spatial information.
And we also have to orient them to the fact that we have both still and video camera built in, and we want them to record their history, their story, their practices, and then go around the community and produce the photos and tag them with the time and place and send it away to us.
Thank you, Ed. And I'm going to come to Brian, and then we're going to take a break. Just want to thank you for your outstanding contribution and your stand for OLC, One Laptop Per Child.
don't forget, first, thank the thousands of people who made it happen.
Yeah,
thank
it's pretty good. Yeah, thank you. And we'll have one last from Brian. Now, Brian endlessly committed energy to making the conference happen. His wife, Kalia, developed the Open ID standard. She's Identity Woman. And Brian set up the wiki for the conference, where I hope all the emergent stuff is going to end up. So thank you, Brian.
All right, thank you. And as a full disclosure, I have to tell you that I write a national blog column on electronics recycling, so I have some things to talk about the One Laptop Per Child people with. Where does that stuff go when it breaks, you know, and contain the toxins? Okay, so at any rate, yeah, we'll talk about that. Anyway, so here's a little bit of a jumble of a thought and see what you can pick out of it. And that is that it occurs to me that there's a bright line in the current information ecosystem on the net. And the bright line is those on one side of that bright line, their daily tasks, their interests, their goals, their development of their organizations have to do with taking the data that is on the net and organizing it in some way and looking through it or finding it or whatnot. And so you just get endlessly more clever and you scale and you delve, and it's just what's on the net, that's your territory. And there's also, by the way, a gravitational pull towards virtual reality in that area. And so you get the second, like, well, let's just make it all completely virtual. You know, like, okay, that's not me. Okay, so the other side of the line is the data acquisition area. And there, it seems that, you know, you have sometimes extremely difficult circumstances to acquire good data. You have good people in the sciences questioning the validity of the acquisition and where does it come from. There's a lot of cost, there's a lot of difficulty, there's a lot of time, there's inertia, it's all sorts of things. It's a messy situation. However, as someone concerned with the environment, I'm on that side of the line. I'm very much concerned with the state of living systems, where we're going with climate and toxics, heavy metals, you know, things like that. So with that's one thought. And then the other thought is with the eBay developer folks, they said something that stuck in my head. And they said, once we set up the system and we saw it grow, we stopped trying to invent features. Instead, we started looking more closely at what our users were doing, and we learned from them. So we stopped. Yeah, okay, we got the. So maybe the challenge is with some of these situations is that we need to, you know, become more, look with fresh eyes and with a great deal of inventiveness. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, there's a thought. Pick something out of that if you care to.
Well, I'm just, you know, we're seeing a great revolution in user-created data on the web. You know, in the early days of the web, it was a read-only web. And now everybody has a blog, and even kids now are creating their own MySpace. And they'll graduate from MySpace, and they'll develop their own web presence. And so we're seeing kind of a transformation. Particularly in the younger generations, people aren't willing to be on the other side of the bright line, as you described it, to be merely consumers of data. You know, we're giving the power of data creation to everybody. Cameras, keyboards, location sensing devices, even voice recording and speech recognition later on. So as we develop better and better hardware and software tools for people to create data, they will create data. And that goes with mapping tools now. So we saw first the placial maps that empower anybody to start creating geodata, and now, you know, Google has got My Maps, and, you know, certainly Microsoft and Yahoo and others are going to follow along with easier and easier tools for people to record the ground truth of their world and to create valid data that can be groomed, manicured, and tested for scientific veracity by experts. So I think I'm very hopeful that we're in fact moving that way.
Nice work.